Take your Bibles, if you will, and turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. It's been a confusing couple of weeks for me to study without my commentaries and without my entire library. I had my computer, and so believe it or not, all I had was the Bible. And so y'all should be smiling at that when you say all you had was the Bible. And so it's been very, very encouraging to me to be able to kind of do some study. And I think I got so much stuck in my head over the last couple of weeks that this morning's message is not going to be long, although I guess I got to make up for Dwayne. Dwayne told me that he was a little short in his message a couple of weeks ago so that I could make up for it this morning. But we will be looking at one verse in the Beatitudes. If you'd stand with me, please. Matthew chapter 5, we'll begin verse 3, as we have been for a couple of months now. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. And may the Lord add his blessings to the reading of the word. You may be seated. Once again, in contemplation and in study for this passage, Matthew 5 reminds me that this is really the central teaching of Jesus. And if you really wanted to know, Jesus' 33 years of life here and his 3 years of ministry, if there was something that you could say, what was the center part of it? What was seminal to to Jesus' teaching? I think you could come here. I think you could come to this, the entire couple of chapters of the Sermon on the Mount, but specifically, I think it's summed up here in the Beatitudes. The thing is, if Jesus' teaching is that if we understand our poverty of spirit, if we understand just how much we don't have anything to offer God, that we begin to mourn over that very plight. We begin to look at that and to say to ourselves, what is it? I've got really nothing to offer. And we begin to understand our conditions. We find ourselves in that position of being extremely meek. We've looked at this over the last several weeks of studying, that I'm poor in spirit. I have an understanding about it, that forces me to be amazingly meek, and therefore I need something, and so I thirst. I hunger for something to satisfy me, to fill that void, and so I begin to thirst and hunger over righteousness. Now that causes us to pursue the holiness. That's what Jesus is talking about here. This isn't something that we're earning. This isn't something that there's going to be a payday at the end if we have reached a certain limit of all of this, that I've done all of these steps. But it causes us, it's a nature within us, to be able to say, this is who I am. And as I begin to see who I am, I begin to pursue holiness. Disciples yearned for that. They yearned for God's righteousness, and they seriously pursue it. Something which over the last several weeks has been back again on my mind. The idea that somehow we just want to add to, being caught up in the southern life of Florida and whatever, you see that it is, in essence, mainly a pursuit of your self-interest. The vast majority, I mean, it's also here in Western PA, and it's in culture in general, but to be immersed in it completely, to be able to see that it is all about self-actualization. It's all about just getting my car washed, or my breakfast this morning, and what is going to be the easiest way for me to be able to get through this particular day, just seems to have immersed me over the last couple of weeks into that lifestyle. Yes, we have it here, and yet I look at the culture and I say that we're guilty of that also. To say that this is really what the kingdom is about. This is what kingdom children live like. We pursue holiness. There are standards within our lives. It is a hunger that I have for righteous things. It's a thirst that I have for righteousness. That's the emphasis. That's what Jesus is doing here. Jesus is turning this completely on its head. Sadly, during this particular era, the Jewish nation, Romans in particular, but even the Jewish nations themselves seem to have put an amazing picture of true religiosity, true righteousness. They put that emphasis on outward experiences, how you actually did. Were you able to keep the law? Here's a new Pharisaical law, and we need to strive toward it. The emphasis went on the outside, and Jesus is going to come along and say this entire message is going to be, there's going to be an outside change, but that isn't the emphasis that we put on it. We put the outside emphasis change based upon the inside change within each of us. It was shallow. The Jewish nations with their religious way, if you will, was amazingly shallow, superficial. And Jesus, just like John the Baptist had predicted, when John the Baptist was in the process of baptizing people at the River Jordan, and the Pharisees came out to see what this big hoopla was all about, John the Baptist was doing, Matthew chapter 3, and verse 7 through 10. This is, listen to what he says to them. But when John the Baptist saw the Pharisees and the Sadducees coming to his baptism, he said to them, "You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Bear fruit in keeping with repentance, and do not presume to say to yourselves, 'Oh, we have Abraham as our father.' For I tell you, God is able to raise from these stones children for Abraham. Even now, the axe is laid to the root of the trees. Every tree, therefore, that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire." John the Baptist was saying, the Messiah is about to arrive, and he is going to bring an axe to your religiosity. He's going to be cutting down at the very roots that which you think is earning you righteousness and favor with God. He says he's going to turn it completely on its head. And onto the scene comes Jesus, and he says that very thing. "I'm more concerned about your attitude than your actions." Now, don't get me wrong, okay? He is very concerned about our actions. But he is much more concerned about the attitude which leads to those particular actions. He's more worried about our conduct or our character, as I began to think about it this week. And having read before, leaving over the last couple of weeks, Martin Lloyd-Jones, he's very, very much involved in Martin Lloyd-Jones is in writing in this, that God was much more worried about my character than he is about my very conduct. It's going to be affected, but he's much more worried about who I am. Lloyd-Jones wrote this: "A Christian is someone before he does anything." He is someone before he does anything. To be this child of the King, to belong to God's kingdom, to be a Christian, to be a saved person, means that you possess a new nature. You have a certain kind of disposition about you. And what does that disposition look like? Sermon on the Mount. That's what he is saying. It isn't something that we're going to earn. Lloyd-Jones goes on to say, "We are not meant to control our Christianity, but rather our Christianity is meant to control us." See what he's saying? We're not simply meant to say, "I'm a Christian and therefore I have to act in this particular way." No, we just simply stand back and say, "I am a Christian. I am, and it is going to control the way that I act." That's what Jesus is concerned about here. And so we've looked at the first four Beatitudes. We're going to be looking at the fifth this morning, poor in spirit, mourning over that fact, leading us to a gentleness, a sense of meekness about it, that I really don't have anything to offer, so somebody's got to give me something. And therefore, it takes us right to that point of hungering and thirsting for that, to be able to say that if I don't have it, I have to have it. And so I'm hungering and I'm thirsting for it. It's bankruptcy of spirit. I can't do anything, cannot do anything to please God in and of my own nature. You understand that? That's how destitute we are. That's what poverty of spirit actually means. I can do nothing. God has got to reach out to me. If I'm to have anything, he's got to reach out to give it to me. We mourn about that. And there's a shame that comes from it. It's important for us to understand this. This series of messages, I think, is important for our church to have, and I don't want it to be a depressing particular time, because we're going to look at, before the end of the series of messages, we're going to see all that God has given us. But it begins with the fact that I live in a state of mourning. I live in a particular position that I got nothing to offer God, that He doesn't see any good in me. I'm dead. I'm an enemy with God. I put Him on the cross. That's how much I hate God in my natural state. That's what he's saying. And so we see that within ourselves, and we begin to thirst for something different. I get to thirst for a righteousness outside of myself. I have to have it. If I'm to have a right relationship with God, I have to have this righteousness. So it has to come from outside of myself. And so that's what we've seen in the first four. So we come to the fifth beatitude this morning, and that is in verse 7. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Now, once again, I want you to stay with me this morning in my jumbled up thought process, because I had no idea which way to take this message this morning. I'm going to make a connection, hopefully, between the word mercy, so we begin to understand where this is actually coming from, where it's the source of it. But I want to make a connection between that and some other words that we see within Scripture, and see how they're closely connected, so that we begin to see how different this word mercy is. It's connected to these other words, but at the same time is involved within them, but they're completely different. And you'll see, hopefully, as the morning message progresses. But what's it really mean? What does it mean to be merciful? What does it mean to show mercy? In Googling a bunch of different things to find out some of the human perspective of what mercy is, you came across many of them. One of the ones I haven't quoted for many years, who I don't really like, and that's Shakespeare. But Shakespeare has a wonderful quote about mercy. Now listen to what he says. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesses him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his own crown. Mercy. That is Shakespeare extolling the virtues, the human virtues of mercy. And we see those virtues. The problem is that most humans would take a look at mercy and we misunderstand it from a biblical perspective. We want to look at this mercy as simply that somehow this is a path to immediate blessings. Okay, verse 7, okay, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. And so there's this pathway. If I want to be blessed, if I want other people to be merciful to me, then all I simply have to do is to be merciful. Or it's a way that I can kind of force God's hand into prospering me. If you've watched the American Gospel, the movie The American Gospel, which we're recommending as a church, you'll see the prosperity gospel taught within that. That somehow, if I'm merciful to God, if I'm merciful to other people, if I give my $10 to the church, that tenfold will be returned to me. That somehow I can force God's hand by that. Is that what this is saying? That it's simply, if blessed are the merciful, because they'll be receiving mercy. Is that what that means? That somehow I force God, that God's going to somehow pay me back. Is it on a human level, is the question that we ask. Can I almost intimidate people? You know, if I'm just merciful, I kill them with kindness. You ever heard that? Kill them with kindness. Sometimes most evil people are the ones who simply try to kill you with kindness. Okay? I mean, there's almost a dichotomy going on in the midst of it. But there's a sense of it that this is a formula in life. That if I'm simply merciful, then all these things of mercy will come back to me. That's not what this is saying. It is so much greater than a human platitude or a human operative of truth, if you will. That if we follow this, this is what's going to occur on this human level. God has taken this so much higher. Jesus has taken this to an amazing level. Remember Jesus talking in the culture that he's talking to at this time. He's talking in a Roman empire. They, of all people, didn't in any way admire mercy. You know, our culture doesn't really admire too much today. There are certain groups and little pockets of people that may look at mercy with a little more becoming light. But keep in mind the culture that Jesus is actually stepping into right here. This was nothing to be admired. Any of you that have studied any type of the Roman Empire or watch any of the particular documentaries or movies about that Roman Empire, you will find nothing about mercy being a virtue. Just the opposite. That they loved power. They loved strength. If mercy was to be shown, it was a weakness in people. The gladiators, when they would have them down and they were looking, should I grant mercy, should I not? It was weak to grant mercy to your opponent at that particular time. It was also considered a disease. If you were too merciful, it was actually, you have a disease of the soul, is what this culture would have said. These are sick people. These would be people that would be institutionalized if they were merciful people. That's the culture that Jesus is stepping into. And it's really not unlike our time completely. Being merciful, being forgiving, being kind, being gentle, overlooking other people's transgressions against you, somehow is weakness. How many times have I heard in counseling sessions when it could be husband and wife, it could be friendships or whatever, there'll be a sense that the people that will come to me will hear from other friends, and unfortunately even in the Christian world, you don't deserve that. You don't deserve to be treated that way. And so you need to stand up for yourself. You need to not show mercy. You need to not be kind in the midst of this. Even in the Christian world, that's the way we seem at times to... And granted, the person shouldn't have been treated that way, but that's our default situation. We just step back and say, you didn't deserve to be treated that way. And so there's even a sense within our own culture that this idea of mercy is a weakness. No, you need to stand up and you need to be strong in this matter because you were wronged. Well, it's to a different degree, different level, but that's exactly what the Romans would have said. This isn't simply some simple concept of giving and receiving Jesus is talking about here, this mercy, this idea. It goes simply further than that. It isn't simply a way of making me happy. If I simply want to have people to be merciful to me all the time so that I'm somehow happy, all I have to do is show them mercy. That's not what Jesus is saying. I want you to think about it. If the reward itself was in this concept being followed, if we simply said, you follow this, the reward is built into that, the worst example of that would have been Jesus himself. You think about it. Who is more merciful than Jesus when he walked the face of this earth? Do you have any examples of Jesus not showing mercy? Just constantly, isn't it? I mean, he eats with tax collectors. He eats with sinners. He doesn't go with the haves. He goes with the have-nots continually. You constantly see Jesus' compassion for the hurting, for the blind, for the naked, for those which need healing. You see Jesus going out of his way to do it, to touch the hem of his garment, and he senses it. His kindness, his mercy is so great in his life that he senses it all the time. I mean, there are so many examples of miracles that we have in the scriptures that we have recorded, but there's so many more that aren't recorded. Jesus constantly showed mercy to people. And so if the reward was in itself, in this precept, then Jesus missed out completely on it. Remember Jesus talking to the woman taken in adultery? They want to kill this woman. And by law, they had every right to when they bring her to just to test Jesus. And what's he say about his mercy toward her? I don't condemn you. So go and don't sin anymore. Just a constant picture of mercy Jesus was. So if that's what this meant, if it was human platitude, then nobody would have placed Jesus upon a cross. The very people that he was showing mercy to are the ones who completely were merciless to Jesus. And so it isn't a picture of that. They spit upon him. They drive a crown of thorns into his head. They then nail him to a cross so that he can die the most excruciating death. Any mercy whatsoever in that picture? The most merciful person ever to walk the world dies the most merciless death. This is a lot higher than some human level. So much greater than simply on some human level just to be merciful so that somehow we have this returned to us. This is mercy which grows out of a relationship with God. The mercy that he's talking about here is a divine mercy. It is coming out of the kingdom of darkness and living in a brand new kingdom of light. Coming out of the kingdom of Satan himself and living into the kingdom of God. It is about this right relationship with God that he himself is going to form in us, right divine mercy. That's what it is. It is so far above this human platitude of simply showing kindness or mercy and expecting something in return. And so what does the word mean? We begin to take a look at it. Once again, it's somewhat difficult this week looking at these words to be able to piece them all together, especially in the Old Testament Hebrew. Jay and I have talked about a couple words in the Hebrew that we struggle with, you know, in our concepts today, because it's almost impossible for us to be able to, and this is one of them, almost impossible to look at it. But we can begin with the Greek word when we look at this word for mercy. I think Elio or Elio, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. But the idea about it is simply to care for the afflicted. There's action going to be taken here, but it's caring for the afflicted. It's giving help to the wretched. It's not simply given to the it's not a picture of simply helping the next door neighbor grandmother who is 95 years old and as sweet as Aunt Jemima herself, and she just happened to fall and you need to go over and help her up. She needs some help. Now, this has gone to the 16-year-old neighbor who you wish moved south, okay, away from your home, so he's no longer near you. And it is showing kindness to him because he has fallen and he is afflicted. It has to do with sympathy. It has to do with compassion. It's a sense of divine compassion. It's not some weak sympathy that man can conjure up. I don't like that 16-year-old. I don't like that kid, but I know I got to do it. I know I have to go over there and be kind to him and help him get off that tractor because he hurt himself. So I reluctantly go over and do that. I can muster that up in me. There's a sense that within the human nature and on this carnal level, I can muster that up. Many, many people are able to do that. But that's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about something that very inner of us, very, very at the very core, to be I'm completely unselfish about this matter. This kid needs help, and I feel his misery at that time, and I'm going to help him. The Hebrew word, same way. This is where it becomes difficult for us to be able to look at the different words that are used for mercy within the Old Testament. Because there are different words that are used, and they're interpreted mercy. But it's hard for us to be able to translate it down to one word, to be able to say it translates this to English. It's very difficult, and several of the words, but specifically this. But one of the words, as I studied a little bit of John MacArthur this week, was the idea of loving kindness. You may have the King James Version, some of the authorized versions, the older ones, use this word quite often. Loving kindness. And I thought about that. I thought I understood what loving kindness was, but I'm not so sure that I did. But it's an English word that we do, loving kindness. And it has an idea that our motives and our actions are connected. It isn't simply something that I feel bad for that kid. I really feel bad for him, hurting, laying there. But it's causing me to jump into actions. It's for me to be to a particular point where I get inside. And I did read one of the commentaries I was able to get a hold of, where you get inside the very skin of people. It would have been a concept that the Hebrews would have thought of, literally getting inside the skin of people to be able to experience, to empathize their thought process, to be able to feel their hurt in the midst of it, and then to take some type of action. And I thought about that this week. What an encouragement that is for those involved in our church and any of our counseling ministries. To get that close to people, not simply to give the platitudes of the Scriptures, not simply to give platitudes of good advice, but to sit with them on that particular level where I hurt with that person, that I feel their pain, that literally I'm somehow almost inside of their skin at that time, and that their experience is my experience at that time. And that drives me then to show great mercy. That's the picture of it. And the Bible is so replete. The Bible is so full of the idea that God Himself in all aspects shows mercy. I don't have time. This is one of the, I was going to take the message in this way, and I'm just going to read you some passages here. But all these different aspects of mercy. So if you're taking notes, write these down. You can read them later on this afternoon. Psalm 119, verse 64. The earth, O Lord, is full of your steadfast love. The word hesed, with one of the most difficult words in the Hebrew to be able to interpret for us. Endless, everlasting love, a sense of mercy. Many of the versions actually said instead of the steadfast love, they say mercy. The Lord, you're full of mercy. Genesis 32:10. I'm not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love, of mercy, and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your service. Servant. 2 Samuel 24:14. Let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for His mercy is great. I was just thinking, I don't know why I missed this. I won't talk about it. We'll talk about it in Sunday school. Remind me about David wanting to fall into the hands of a merciful God. Nehemiah 9:19. You in your great mercies do not forsake them in the wilderness. Here's God sending the children of Israel out into the wilderness. And in His great mercies, He's not going to forsake them. Psalm 69:13. But as for me, my prayer is to you, O Lord, at an acceptable time, O God, in the abundance of your mercy, answer me in your saving faithfulness. Psalm 145:9. The Lord is good to all, and His mercy is over all that He has made. You can't look outside. You can't look at His creation. You can't look at a newborn. You can't look at anything without seeing the mercy of God, because it covers all things. Lamentations 3:22. The steadfast, loving kindness, mercy of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. It's amazing. I've never studied this word mercy until this past week. I wish I had. And you'll see that as I begin to do some comparison here, why I think it's so important. And so you see it within Scriptures. You see it constantly being talked about, that God's mercy covers all. It's one of His amazing attributes. I just got done with this conference. Well, at least I saw half the conference at Ligonier. And it was on the attribute of His holiness. I can't wait for one of the conferences to look at His mercy, to be able to take a specific look at what does it mean about God's mercy. How does that apply to me? And we're going to see that as we do some comparison here with some other words. It's we're going to use like forgiveness, and we're going to use grace, we're going to use justice, and we're going to use God's love, and see how all of those words we talk about God are connected to His mercy. And the first one I wanted to look at is the word forgiveness. Titus 3:5 says this. This is a comparison of the word mercy with God's forgiveness. Titus 3:5. He saved us. Not because of works done by us, even in righteousness, but according to His own mercy. Have you thought about it? Mercy. It's the attribute of God that drove Him to save you, not of your own acts of righteousness, because you're poor in spirit. You have poverty in your spirit. You have nothing to offer. And so this amazing, merciful God saves us. That's what we see. He forgave us of those sins. It's a fruit of mercy. Forgiveness is a fruit of mercy. God looks at us with amazing compassion. God looks upon a people which are absolutely in hatred with Him. that are absolute enemies with Him. And He has amazing mercy for them. He realizes what sin has done to them. He realizes the outcome of the sin upon their lives. He realizes the misery that they live in. And He's driven to save us. That's mercy. Mercy is behind this forgiveness. It's an attribute of God that leads to forgiveness. It's sympathy toward our suffering, the outcast, us as downtrodden people in need. Daniel 9:9 says, "To the Lord our God belong mercy and forgiveness." I get excited about it. Just saying this more out loud, I get more excited about it. To the Lord our God belong mercy and forgiveness, for we have rebelled against Him. We have rebelled against Him. I don't want anything to do with Him. And He looks at me in my absolute misery and says, "I'll forgive him." Amazing picture of God's mercy. We think mercy is simply God's withholding judgment, don't we? That's all it is, that we believe. Mercy is God just simply withholding judgment. But the reason that He withholds judgment in mercy is because He has forgiven us of our sins. We simply say that that mercy is simply withholding this judgment. The only reason that He can show that mercy to me is because He has forgiven my sins. If He hasn't forgiven my sins, He cannot show mercy. There's an amazing connection between those two words. Mercy is also linked to the word love. Listen to Ephesians 2:4. "But God, being rich in mercy, because of great love with which He loved us." But God being rich in mercy because of great love with which He loved us. Mercy flows into forgiveness, but it flows out of an overarching love that God has for His people. He has an amazing love for people. And because of that, He sees this amazing need for mercy upon these miserable people. And He, in that mercy, forgives sins for us. And so we see this connection between this idea of mercy and the love of God. It's much more broad than it is. The word love is much broader than the word mercy is. Thomas Watson, the old Puritan, wrote this. I've read this so many times, almost had it memorized. "Mercy properly respects them that are miserable. Love is of a larger consideration. Love is like a friend that visits them that are well. Mercy is set just for the miserable. Love is bigger, but mercy is an expression of love. Mercy, we might say, is a physician for the sick. Love is a friend to everyone. Love acts out of affection. Mercy acts out of compassion. Love is constant. Mercy is for times of misery." You see how this word calls us to action? To be able to say, "Oh, I may love people. I may love people within this church and have an overarching perspective of just love for each of you. But for me to show mercy means that when CJ is hurting, that I see it. And I know I can step into her life and begin to help relieve that particular misery." It's much different, the love and the mercy, but they're connected. They're inseparable, but yet they're completely different also. I got to keep moving. I want to, but I have to, because I want to look at this idea of mercy and grace. We're big on grace at this church. Christians themselves are big on grace, and we talk about that a lot. But there is an amazing connection and there's an amazing difference between this word grace and mercy. It's another word, this grace, that enters into this discussion here. That word eleos, whatever, once again, this idea for for mercy and its derivatives always seems to take care of a particular pain, always seems to be taking care of misery or a particular distress, which are the results of sin. Grace deals with the sin in general. Mercy deals with the outcomes of that sin and the misery that we have. And I hope we're beginning to see that because it's different. Sometimes they say, oh, you're just parsing words. Yeah, Jesus parses words, so we need to parse words at times. But there's an amazing difference when grace itself simply deals with this overarching perspective of the sin in general, that grace is going to deal with that. For by grace you have been saved. But mercy itself deals with the misery caused by that sin. Mercy looks at the misery that sin produces. Grace looks at the sin itself. God gives grace for our sin and mercy for our misery. Grace for our sin, mercy for our misery. Pardon the crime, that's grace. Mercy offers relief from the punishment of the crime. That's the difference. There's relief from this crime. Okay, you're pardoned, that's grace. Mercy, I'm going to grant you relief from the very punishment which you deserve. And you'll see that here in a little bit. Grace comes first. It renders me no longer guilty before God. Mercy comes second, and it delivers me from the punishment that should be handed out because of it. Grace says not guilty. That's grace, not guilty. Mercy says you don't have to pay the price either. Not only you're not guilty, you don't have to go through that anymore. That's the picture. That's the difference. We have an overuse of it. I read this from this week of an editorial somewhere from a North Carolina pastor, as a matter of fact, when I was down there. And the difference between and how we overuse the word grace as compared to the word mercy. Now, once again, I'm convinced Christians cannot overuse this word grace, okay? But comparatively speaking, with when we use it with in connection with this word mercy, we may have a tendency to overuse it. Because we know that Ephesians says that, for by grace you have been saved. It doesn't say, for by mercy you have been saved. It says, for by grace you have been saved. And so as I began to think about it, I cannot find who to give credit to. It's not my word, so I can't give credit to somebody else. But I remember reading one time that mercy is the servant. Mercy is the servant to the glory of grace. That mercy is the servant to the glory of grace. Thought about 1 Peter 1:3, and I'll try to explain that, what I mean by this and how it plays out. Listen to what Peter says. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again. Not according to his great grace. Does Peter know the difference? Does Peter know this difference between grace and mercy? Is it just simply interchangeable words here that you could use one or the other? He's very specific. He says, according to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again. And then if you look at that 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 through about 7 or 8, it's amazing, wonderful passage that we've been born again. And then he goes on to say about all of these things, these good things which have been given to us by God's grace. A living hope, our salvation, our protection, our inheritance. The fact that all of this is being kept at the very throne room of God. And that there's an abundance of salvation at that particular end time to be handed out to us. That's all Peter talking about here. But he starts off not about grace. He talks about the grace. He talks about all that we're given in that area. But he begins it by saying, but according to his great mercy, you have been born again. Because mercy is a servant to the glory of grace. This overarching perspective that all these good things are given to me. There was something bad. There was misery that had to be taken care of first. That's mercy. That's what we see. That's where we see his mercy. Listen to what Peter says in it. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope. But listen to this. Through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. There's the misery. Death. the requirement for my sins, the requirement for your sin, the misery. God in His mercy says, I'm not going to pass that upon you. I'm going to show mercy to you, and I'm going to grant that this punishment not be given to you. That's mercy. That's not grace. Grace is all of the other things that come from it. Grace is the new life, that protection that I have in heaven, that the living hope that He has within me. That's all grace. That's all the good things. We don't like to talk about that. And I think that's typical within us today. I think that's typical within Christian circles. We all like good things to come our way, don't we? I like getting things. Folks, I love getting your text messages when I'm down south. Okay? When I'm down there and I get texts from up north, I smile. Because they're encouraging to me to hear from y'all. And phone calls. Okay, don't ever think that you bother Tammy and I when we're away, because it's not. It's good things. We like to have them. The right words at the right time. The right words of encouragement. It's that truth that we can constantly hear as Christians. That we want to lean upon the good things of life. We want to be surprised by the good things. It just seems to be a natural fit. God's graciousness is going to hand out all good things to me. I will spend eternity with Him. What a hope that I have. That's where I want to be. That's where I want to think about. I want to think about the good things. I want to think about having all that God has promised me. I want to think of the good times about being back home here. I don't want to think about any of the bad things. And even though mercy is taking care of those bad things, I still want to put those things on the back burner. Grace has the added benefit of being a doctrine also, which doesn't provoke Christians to circle their wagons in different ideas and different concepts, whether we're covenantal or whether we're dispensational or whether we believe in a limited atonement or whether it's unlimited atonement or whatever. We all agree in God's grace. We all can talk about that. And so we don't want to look at the disputed things at times because it can be just a little prickly. And so we don't necessarily want to be able to do that at times. But we'll talk about God's grace. And I think that's the reason that we see this amazing overusage, if you will, within our talk about grace. And sometimes we don't reflect upon God's mercy. Mercy was to say the punishment has been taken care of. Punishment, mercy will remind me too many of the negative things in life, that there was a requirement of God's justice and His holiness which has been violated, which requires death. And therefore, mercy has to be granted. I would rather talk about God's grace. I would rather talk about all the good things that God has given to me. But those good things don't occur without God's mercy, first and foremost, being poured out upon me in the form that my death, the death which was required for me to have, was given to His Son, Jesus Christ. Mercy and justice is another word that goes hand in hand with each other. And I want to hurry here because I don't want to spend all day on this. But it's another word that goes hand in hand. Mercy and God's justice. God cannot be merciful. He cannot be merciful if somehow that mercy violates His justice. The one thing that we heard at this conference this past week is God's holiness. You can take any of His attributes. You can take any of His actions. They cannot violate any of His other attributes. They have to work hand in hand. And it's the same way here. God cannot be merciful if somehow His actions of mercy violates His attribute of justice. The saying that sin has occurred. My justice and my holiness have been violated and it demands payment. God cannot be merciful if He simply ignores His other attributes. And so His justice now is going to require payment for sinful man. Adam and Eve did it to us. They did it to us. And then you and I do it to ourselves. But either way, we're doomed because of it. Punishment has to be handed out. God's justice and His holiness demand it. They demand it, so He cannot show mercy at the extent of not tearing through with His justice and His holiness. And so it has to be handed out. So what does God do? I can only be merciful to these people, these miserable people that are destitute, that have nothing, these people that are destined for hell. I want to show them mercy. But my justice and my holiness demands payment. And so what's the answer? Justice, His holiness, are satisfied in the death of His Son, Jesus Christ. And now He's free to grant me forgiveness. He's free now to grant me mercy. Only because His justice and His holiness have been upheld. We can define this in some practical terms for me to leave you with this morning. Because once again, there's a ton of theology here. I love theology. I think that it strengthens us. But we need some practical terms. And I think that what we see in the picture of this divine judgment, this picture of God Himself and how He has shown mercy, this picture of Jesus Christ and how He has shown mercy to us, it bears insults, doesn't it? Do we bear insults of evil men? Do we bear up under those? When they take our coat, do we give them the rest of our garments? When we're punched in the face, do we simply turn the other cheek to them? Do we bear those particular insults of evil men because we see them? We see them in their misery? How many of us have ever looked upon that? Oh, I'm being treated badly. I don't deserve to be treated that way. Well, maybe you don't. Don't pray for what you deserve, by the way. But our perspective, maybe you don't. But do we begin to look at the person that's treated me that way as somebody who they themselves are miserable? They themselves are caught up in this sin. They themselves are objects of the wrath of God. Do we begin to see it as such? To be able to say, I live in their world now. I'm inside their skin. Do I begin to see that and to be able to say, I've been shown amazing mercy. Undeserving. I can't help but show a mercy to this particular person. It's much more than simply bearing up under an insult. You know, us English like to say to stiff up a better lip. You know, just push through it. You know, is that what we're talking about here? No, it's beginning to see that I'll bear up underneath it, but I begin to see it from the perspective of the miserable person that is doing it to me. The terrible misery. I'm willing to be insulted. I'm willing to be persecuted for the sake of God. I'm sympathetic to these people. I'm simply not going to bear up, but I'm truly sympathetic when I begin to look at people that are caught in the sin, how often I have done my counseling and begin to think when I get frustrated with this particular person, refuses to see it, I begin to actually visualize them being in chains themselves or in prison garb themselves. To be able to say, they're enslaved to this. They're miserable people because sin has such a grasp on them. Are we gentle to the weak? Or do we pass by? Are we generous to the poor? Are we gracious to those people that are offensive to us? We have to remember that we were amazing recipients of the mercy of God. We're amazing recipients of the mercy. Every breath that we take is based upon the mercy of God, that He hasn't annihilated us. Psalms 37:21. The righteous is generous and gives. I love the King James in this one. The righteousness shows mercy and gives. They see it. They see it for what it is. Not only do I feel compassion, but I give to the case. I give of whatever I have, whether it's my time, whether it's my finances, whatever it could be. It's a matter of taking my compassion and putting action to it. You think of Abraham and Lot. Abraham weren't getting along because the people were fighting amongst themselves and the land isn't big enough. So Abraham said, look, we're going to have to split up. Let's kind of split this thing up evenly. And Lot says, I'll take the best. And he takes off into the perfect areas. And Abraham, then he goes off into less liked area. And he's going to eke out. Well, what happens when Lot ends up being run over by the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and the rest of them? Abraham, in great mercy, comes to his aid and fights and rescues him. What about Joseph after he's being treated badly? Joseph, You didn't deserve this. You didn't deserve. Your brother sold you into slavery. You spent how many years in prison? You didn't deserve any of that. Nothing that you've gone through did you deserve that. But Joseph, in an amazing time of mercy, looks at his brothers and says, "You meant it for evil, but God's meant it for good. I've got what you need. Come, you can eat. Take care of our family." Mercy, a picture of mercy. Moses and Miriam. Miriam rebels against them. God strikes her down with leprosy. What's Moses do? He cries out in Numbers 12, "Heal her now, O Lord." Not, "She had it coming." Okay, she had it coming. Just leave her be in her misery with it. No, it was mercy that drove Moses to say, "Heal her now, O Lord." David, mercy, sneaking through the caves. Saul's tried to kill him. Here he is asleep. He's asleep. Nobody will know. I cut his head off right now. My problems are over. But in great mercy, David says, "I won't do that. I won't touch the hand of the Lord's anointed. I'm not going to do that." To a picture of mercy. In a world of merciless people that we currently live in today, that people are so consumed with self-actualization, self-protection, all about me, whatever I've got, whatever I'm entitled to, isn't it amazing that God has deposited kingdom-loving citizens who are to act differently? We're to step back and say, "I'm not of this world. I'm a sojourner. I'm an alien. I'm trying to go outside the camp to find the city that I belong to because I don't belong here. But I'm going to live like I'm in the city." That's what we see here. The source of all of this is God, isn't it? That's what we've been seeing in the first four Beatitudes. I got nothing. I'm destitute. I'm poor in spirit. I'm hungering for that which I need. I'm meek about this. God, if you don't reach out and do something for me, I'm not going to have it. The source of our mercy that you and I will display to one another, right back to God Himself. It's the very source. It's nothing that we're going to be able to somehow drum up. Get a thought about this week, and I'm actually going to preach an entire message on it, and I may someday. The question's been asked many times, how do people in the Old Testament get saved? Because doesn't Romans tell us that with your mouth you have to confess Jesus Christ, Son of God, dead, buried, now living for us? Well, Romans says that we need to confess that. People of the Old Testament couldn't do it. They didn't know about Jesus. They had an idea about a Messiah coming, but they didn't know about Jesus. They couldn't confess Jesus. So how were they saved? They were saved right here. This is how they were saved, based upon the Beatitudes. Coming to a particular point, realizing they're destitute without anything. God has given us commands to obey. I can't do them. And God says that we need to do them. If I'm going to have a relationship with Him, I've got to be able to do this. But I can't do them. And by virtue of that, I begin to mourn over my situation. I begin to mourn over my current state. I begin to find myself saying, "Lord, if you don't do it, I'll not get it. And so I'm hungering for it, Lord. I want it. I want your righteousness, but I can't do it. You've got to do it for me." That's how people are saved. They come to that particular point. So for us to be able to think somehow within our culture today that I simply raise a hand in church, or I simply come to a particular point in a counseling session where I said, "Listen, Jesus, I want you to fix my life. I want you to fix my marriage. I want you to fix my mindset in all of this because of the promises I've seen in Scripture. Lord, that's what I want. So come and save me and be able to do that." I'm here to tell you the vast majority of those are not true conversions. If we haven't wrestled over our sins, if we haven't come to at least a rudimentary idea that I can't do this, this is impossible, and God demands it, and if God isn't going to do it on my behalf, I'm not going to get it. If we haven't come to some type of rudimentary understanding of that, our conversion probably is of no good. That's what the Scriptures are telling us. But isn't it an amazing picture? all who cry out to Jesus, he'll in no wise cast out. Oh, we come to this particular point. Jesus is saying, now I send them the message of Christ. Now I send it to them. Because he's merciful. He wants to forgive us our sins. That's the picture that we have here. Every time you draw a breath, according to the Puritan, Thomas Watson, every time you draw a breath, you suck in mercy. Every bit of bread you eat, the hand of mercy carries it to you. You never drink but in a golden cup of mercy. When we come to that particular point, we are totally reliant upon Jesus Christ and God for my salvation. That's salvation. That's what we see within the Scriptures. I don't have time to look at it, and we won't, but here's simply to say, if we're merciful, we'll have the mercy of God continually poured out upon us. And it isn't a sum total here that if I have enough mercy, that God's going to give me enough mercy. It's not that, but there is a promise that we find here that as I come to this particular point where I realize that I am a person that has received amazing mercy and I can do nothing but hand that back out to other people, God is simply up there pouring out mercy upon mercy upon mercy upon mercy. We think we hurt. We think we go through those times of depression or physical ailments or relationships that are falling apart and it's amazing hurts within us. God is a merciful God who wants to hand out the punishment onto his son to take this and saying, I don't want you to hurt anymore. My son has paid for that particular sin, but here is the mercy for this particular moment because his mercies are new every morning for us. It doesn't matter what we're facing. As we show mercy to other people because of what God has done within us, and I can't help but do that, he is standing up there with an amazing bucket of mercy and saying, take care of this dude. I'll take care of this Mandy. I want to show you mercy in those particular areas of your life. That's what the Scriptures tell us to do. It's not the human platitude. It's not somehow I'm forcing God's hand in the midst of this. It's simply saying, God, I'm trusting you. God, I got nothing without you. And when we say that to God, he says, but you got everything with me. That's the picture that we have. So with David, we begin to cry out, be gracious to me, O God, for you do I cry all the day. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever.